Thank you for coming out tonight. Can you guys hear me okay there in the nosebleed section? Great, great. This is a very great opportunity for me. My name is Ken Bowers, and I wrote a couple of books, Hiding in Plain Sight and Beneath the Tide. Let me start out with a little history about myself first of all. So you'll know where I'm coming from. When I was a young sprig, about 14 years old, my parents joined the John Birch Society. This is back in the early 60s or so. And they began talking. The society would have these cottage meetings in our home, and they began talking about strange stuff, weird stuff I'd never heard before. They started talking about groups that controlled our government from behind the scenes and all kinds of conspiratorial stuff. And it really, at first it really unnerved me that there were people who would bypass our elected representatives, or at least use them to do what they wanted and submit us to their will. I thought at first, no, that can't be possible. It's we elect our representatives. They're responsible to us. If they don't do what we want, then we'll kick them out of office. You know, you can't fool us like that. So I started investigating it with a half a mind to Some would say that's about all I've got, especially my kids, right? I have my daughters here tonight. But I had half a mind to disprove it, so I started studying it. And now, 35 years later, I know the truth. At first, it was a hobby. Then it became an obsession. And now it's a mission. I'm going to tell you and give you the experience and everything that I have accumulated. Well, that's in a thimble. I'm going to try and give you the benefit of what I have found out. I have all of you received the pages of quotations? Anybody who has not, raised your hand. They're out there. We have some out there that you should have picked up when you came in. There are 17 pages. Well, it's double-sided, so I guess, what, 7 pages now, double-sided, of quotations. And these are not the only ones that I have found evidence to support what I say. But these are some of the best. There are hundreds, thousands of material, quotations, letters, documents, all kinds of stuff, primary source material that bear out what I say. And I'll give you much of the information that I have. So I started investigating this stuff, and around about 1998, after I'd spent more than 25, 30 years investigating it, I said to myself, now, I have enough of the picture. I've assembled enough of the jigsaw puzzle to make a picture. And I said, it's time to put it down on paper. So I started writing. And I published my first book in October of 2000. W. Cleon Skousen got a hold of my book, and he read it. And he got a hold of me. He had me come over to his house. And how many personally know the doctor? Yeah, a lot of people do. He's a friend to so many people, and it's so sad that he passed away so recently. But he read my book and had me come over, and he said, Ken, this is the best book on the subject of conspiracy that I've ever read. And one time, I've been over to his house many times, and one time Glenn Kimber was there, his son-in-law. And I'm sure many of you know him too. And he told Glenn, you know, there are a few people in this world who understand the way the world really works, and Ken is one of them. And I was so pleased at that. It was so pleasing to be regarded so highly by this good gentleman. And I'm going to quote from him and quote from a lot of people tonight. Now, first of all, let me ask you some questions. Who here, I've had this quite advertised all over the place, who came here from outside of Salt Lake County? Okay, where'd you come from? Utah? Davis County? Okay. Okay. Where else? Manti? Oh, man. Oh, this is fantastic. Where did you... Oh, geez. How you guys doing? Well, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to have... because I've had it advertised on KTalk, and I was just wondering what kind of response we'd get. Thank you for showing up. Now... if you want to go, if for some reason you don't get one of these handouts, you can go to my book website right here, excerptsandevidences.com. This is my book website. You can order books, and you can get these same quotations that I'm giving to you. You can get it right on there. You go to excerptsandevidences.com. Click on the new information button, and it will take you right to a page where you can download all of these quotations. And these are from a lifetime of study, and I hope that you... I'm going to go through many of them tonight, and I'm by no means going to go through all of them, but I hope you understand that when I finished with this thing tonight, these quotations are of great value. I hope you understand that. You'll understand them better when I explain them to you. I want to introduce you into the subject of secret combinations today, and I'm going to talk about it from an LDS perspective. So any of you good folks out there who are non-LDS, I'm glad you're here. You'll be able to understand it perhaps from our perspective. I'm going to quote prophets, but I'm not going to only just rely on Mormon scriptures and Mormon background. I have plenty of other material from all over. But primarily I will take this from a LDS background because the majority here are good LDS. So please feel free to pitch right in and enjoy this, even though you may not be of our faith. Thank you very much for coming. Now, the next slide I'm going to show you, I want you to know this shows how important secret combinations are in the overall scheme of things. This shows you how important they are. These conspiracy theories are a smokescreen to hide the incredible truth. Ooh. They say that when a humorist tells a joke, he should never explain it. Never have to explain it. That's how important conspiracy theories are. They're just a smokescreen to hide the incredible truth. I'm going to have little jokes here throughout the evening, and I hope that you relax and enjoy them because, can you see from the corner there? Let me move this out of the way. Because this is a very serious subject, it is, as a matter of fact, when you delve into conspiracy theory, you're delving into something that is incredibly evil. And there is no way to get around it. You can't describe it in any other terms. It's not beautiful. It's not all nice and pleasant and everything's beautiful and everything's rosy. it's an evil subject. And I have found out that when you, as I study these things, that I have to break away from them and try to humor things up a little bit. Because it is so depressing, I try to study these things, and then I take an equal amount of time and study something uplifting, like the scriptures or good books that are ennobling and uplifting. And by doing that, I have been able to keep an even keel on this. And so I'm going to try and use a little humor here tonight to help lighten it up a little bit. And I hope you understand. Maybe I'm just a guy with a weird sense of humor. My kids will tell you that. J. Edgar Hoover was a great man, and there's been a lot of false stories about him, how he was a sexual deviant or something like that. It's not true. It is not true. He was a great man. And he said, in any struggle, it is essential to know what you're fighting for and what you're fighting against. If knowledge of the former is lacking, the will to win will be absent. If knowledge of the latter is absent, confusion and uncertainty will result. Now, I want to tell you something. You folks are soldiers. You're warriors. You're in a war. You are in a war whether you like it or not. You are in a war whether you know it or not. You're all warriors. And you're fighting for something, and you're fighting against something. You want to know what you're fighting for? You are fighting for the freedom of mankind. I hope you are. If you're on the other side and fighting against the freedom of mankind, perhaps you're in the wrong place. You're fighting for the freedom of mankind, for his agency. That's what we say in the LDS. In the LDS faith, you're fighting for the agency of mankind. It was a war that started in heaven before the world was made, and it was a war that had two opponents. One was Jesus Christ, and the other one was Lucifer. And the outcome of that war there was the basis of this same war that's going on today. This same war over the freedom of the individual has been going on since the beginning of time, and it will not stop until Satan is finally conquered. He will never stop. He is always the same, and what he believes in is exactly and totally diametrically opposed to what God and Jesus Christ believe in. If God were to declare a doctrine, Satan would come out against it. What he believes is always 180 degrees opposite of what God believes. And you can take that to the bank. That way, if you see a philosophy of men or a philosophy or an idea that comes up, and it is absolutely 180 degrees opposite of the gospel, you can take it to the bank that it came from Satan. We know that some ideas come from people, some ideas come from Satan, some ideas come from God. The ideas of men tend to go off on tangents from the gospel, but the philosophies of Satan are always 180 degrees opposed to the gospel. To introduce you to this story tonight, I'm going to give this quotation from Dr. Bella Dodd. She was on the National Committee of the Communist Party of America, and then she defected, came over and testified for the FBI, and Dr. W. Cleon Skousen was an FBI agent at this time. He talked to her and she said this to him, "I think the communist conspiracy is merely a branch of a much bigger conspiracy." That's what she said. That really caused him to think. And he says, "What do you mean by that?" And the story goes like this. When she was a communist and she was working during World War II against the government of the United States, and she was taking her orders directly from Moscow, they told her that if the time ever came where communication was interrupted between Moscow and their couriers that they used, if they couldn't communicate with Moscow, and if they needed some instructions, they were to go to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and they were to go to a certain room and talk to three people only. So the time came. During World War II, Germany attacked Russia, and Russia, the Russian army was on the retreat. As a matter of fact, they had to evacuate Moscow. Some of Hitler's soldiers, some of his advance parties, actually came to the outskirts, the suburbs of Moscow. They actually reached them. They almost took Moscow, but they didn't. They never did. They were defeated and pushed back just before they came into the city. So it was, the Soviet government was in disarray for much of this time. And so during the war and shortly after the war, they had some problems with communication. So she went to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel one time and she talked to one of these guys. And it really astounded her. These three people she was told to communicate with were not Russians. They weren't even communists. They were wealthy American capitalists. Wealthy American capitalists. Aren't the commies and the capitalists, isn't the West and the East against each other? Aren't they enemies? She went to these three wealthy American capitalists to get instructions, and she found out that whatever instructions they told her, Moscow always approved their decisions. What's going on here? She began to think about this, and that's why she said this. "I think the communist conspiracy is merely a branch of a much bigger conspiracy." We're going to see that in action tonight. Now, what do the prophets say about secret combinations? I bring this up because before everything, I don't know how you make your decisions in life, but I make my decisions in life based on a spiritual foundation. In Moroni chapter 10, verse 5, "It is by the Spirit that we can learn the truth of all things. By the Spirit of the Holy Ghost, we can learn the truth of all things. And it is on a spiritual basis that you can know the truth of what I'm saying. And I hope that what I say tonight, you will take into your hearts and ask the Holy Ghost to manifest to you whether I'm telling you the truth or not. And I hope he will witness the truth of these things, because it is time for America to wake up. We have been asleep far too long. So what do the prophets say? We're going to start out on a spiritual basis, and then we will go on to good people of throughout the world, and I'm going to show you the evidence for secret combination. First of all, we're going to see what Joseph Smith says. Here's what he says. "Even this nation will be on the verge of crumbling to pieces and tumbling to the ground, and when the Constitution is on the brink of ruin, this people will be the staff upon which the nation shall lean, and they shall bear the Constitution away from the very verge of destruction." Now, Brigham Young, He talked about the same thing, and when he described it as that it would hang by a single thread. But no matter how you describe it, it's describing the same event. And they're talking about our day. And I tell you that they were prophets of God, and they knew what they were saying. They said that the Constitution would be on the brink of ruin, and I tell you it is. It is a shell of its former self. But we have to ask ourselves a question. If the Constitution is going to be brought to the brink of ruin, if it's going to hang by a thread, what will be the agency that will make that happen? What will be the cause of it hanging by a thread or coming to the brink of ruin? To find the answer to that question, let's look into the Book of Mormon, and we'll see what destroyed earlier civilizations. And behold, in the end of this book, the Book of Mormon, ye shall see that this Gadianton, and for those of you who are not of our faith, that in the Book of Mormon, Gadianton was a robber who founded a secret society for the destruction of the government of the Nephites and setting up their own men in their government. He founded a secret combination, a secret society. This Gadianton did prove the overthrow, yea, almost the entire destruction of the people of Nephi. Mormon wrote that in Helaman. And he said that Gadianton and his secret band of robbers, that secret combination, caused almost the entire destruction of the people of Nephi. His son Moroni wrote the Book of Ether, and he said, and they, secret combinations, have caused the destruction of this people of whom I am now speaking, the Jaredites, and also the destruction of the people of Nephi. Those two ancient civilizations were brought to the brink of ruin by secret combinations. So now we have our constitution, our society, on the brink of ruin. And what do you think is almost the entire cause? The same thing that caused the destruction of those ancient societies is the same reason, the same thing that is causing the destruction of our society. Secret combinations and conspiracies are causing the destruction of our Constitution because there are groups of people who are purposely trying to bring about that very result. And I will show you in the slides to come ample evidence to prove that. Now, we're going to read. I would like to give you a little homework assignment. Go home and read the 8th chapter of the Book of Ether. And if you're not LDS, grab a Book of Mormon from your neighbor. Read the 8th chapter of the Book of Ether. It is, the whole chapter talks about secret combinations from beginning to end. The first half of that chapter talks about a secret combination that existed in the days of the Jaredites. The last half of that chapter, Moroni stops his narrative and he talks to us. He talks to us. And here's what he says. And whatsoever nations shall uphold such secret combinations to get power and gain shall be destroyed. Wherefore, O ye Gentiles, and that's us, unto whom this work shall come, that's us. It is wisdom in God that these things, these secret combinations, should be shown unto you. It's wisdom in God that we should find out about such evil, nasty things as secret combinations. Why do you suppose that would be? Why do you suppose it would be wisdom in God that we'd learn about these terrible, nasty things? How will you know what you're fighting against unless you learn about these things? You have to have this knowledge of both good and evil in order to make a wise decision. You're right. So it's wisdom in God that we gain knowledge. And sometimes that knowledge isn't very nice. But I would rather know what's really going on in America than just pretend that all is well in Zion. Yea, Zion prospereth. All is well. I would rather have that knowledge. I want to know. And I've always prized just knowing the truth. And I hope perhaps I can instill that in everybody here tonight. Okay, to continue. It's wisdom in God that these things should be shown unto you, that ye may repent of your sins. Whoa! It's a sin? What kind of sin is he talking about there? And suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you. So apparently it's a sin to just sit around and let these guys combine against you and against society. It must be some kind of sin. I'll tell you why. Because God ordained the constitution of this land. He did it by wise men whom he raised up to this very purpose. He ordained this constitution. And we, if we let these murderous combinations do away with the constitution, we're letting these guys destroy the work of God. He gave it to us for our benefit, and people gave their lives that we might benefit from this free government. So it is up to us to make sure that we fight. We may not be able to overthrow them, but we have to try. To try is equated with righteousness. If you try, if you give your effort, that is equated unto God for righteousness. So, you warriors, are you beginning to see that you are soldiers? Even the sword of the justice of the eternal God shall fall upon you if you suffer these things to be. And I will show you in the next slide what that means from a modern-day prophet. But wherefore, the Lord commandeth you. Whoa. He used the C word. It's a commandment of God. It is a commandment of God. To what? When ye shall see these things come among you, that ye shall awake to a sense of your awful situation. For whosoever buildeth it up seeketh to overthrow the freedom of all lands, nations, and countries. Wherefore I, Moroni, am commanded to write these things. So Moroni was commanded to write them so that he could tell us that we're commanded of God to learn and fight. You warriors. This is no small thing. Here's what President Ezra Taft Benson said. Now, I want to remind you, even the sword of the justice of the eternal God shall fall upon you. Let's see what he means by that in the next slide. He said this in April of 96, and it was reported in the Ensign of May. Unless we as citizens of this nation forsake our sins, political and otherwise, and return to the fundamental principles of Christianity and of constitutional government, we will lose our political liberties, our free institutions, and will stand in jeopardy before God of losing our exaltation. He said that as president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in conference from the podium. And that is the word of the Lord to us, that we LDS believe that. That is the current word of the Lord to us. And that's what he said in conference. We will stand before God and we might lose our exaltation. And that would be the justice of the eternal God falling upon our heads if we suffer these things to be. Y'all happy now? Boy, it just makes me want to run out and hide. I don't know about you guys, but it is very solemn. What is happening is a very solemn thing. Let's go on. Now, here's what President Benson, as president and prophet of the church, said about secret combinations. I testify that wickedness is rapidly expanding in every segment of our society. It is more highly organized, more cleverly disguised, and more powerfully promoted than ever before. Secret combinations lusting for power gain and glory are flourishing. A secret combination that seeks to overthrow the freedom of all lands, nations, and countries is increasing its evil influence and control over America and the entire world. This secret combination, this prophet of God testifies, has control over America. Now, less than a year later in 1989, see, this was reported in the November incident of 1988. Less than a year later, the Berlin Wall fell. Communism, they started perestroika and glasnost. They don't even call themselves the Soviet Union anymore. They're Russia. So it can't be those guys. There's something else. And it's like Bella Dodd said, I think the communist conspiracy is merely a branch of something much bigger. Boy, I bet you're glad you came tonight. This is what Bruce R. McConkie said in 1980, again from the Tabernacle in conference. Gadianton robbers fill the judgment seats in many nations. An evil power seeks to overthrow the freedom of all nations and countries. He agrees with President Benson. Satan reigns in the hearts of men. It is the great day of his power. Now let's translate that into modern English. Gadianton robbers means secret combinations. Fill the judgment seats. Back in the ancient Nephite civilization, they had a chief judge, they had lesser judges, and they had common judges, and they all formed a government of judges, just like the Israelites had. And the judgment seats, to translate that into today's language, that would be positions of power, whatever. It could be a president, could be a prime minister, it could be any head of state, it could be a judge, like a Supreme Court judge or an appellate court judge, it could be a legislator, like a congressman or somebody from the Parliament of Britain or the Russian Duma or the Israeli Knesset or any other legislative body. Now that's what that translates into. So there are Gadianton robbers or secret combinations that fill these positions of power throughout the world. And he says that to us as an apostle of the Lord. Back in the ancient Nephites' days, the Gadianton robbers, did obtain the sole management of the government. They took over the Nephite government back then. But you see, the problem was, back then in the Nephites' days, that government was elected. The people elected the chief judge and the other judges. So somehow they had to run some of their people in elections, and by golly, history repeats itself. That's all I'm going to say about that. Insomuch that they did trample under their feet and smite and rend and turn their backs upon the poor and the meek and the humble followers of God, condemning the righteous because of their righteousness, letting the guilty and the wicked go unpunished because of their money. Boy, that sounds like today. Now, I love Joseph Fielding Smith when he was president and when he was in the upper councils of the church. He always told things exactly the way they were. He did not care to use diplomatic language and spare people's feelings. He just told things exactly the way they were. Satan has control now, period. I mean, you gotta admit, that's pretty direct. Satan has control now, period. No matter where you look, he is in control, even in our own land. He says they're in control. President Benson said they're in control. Bruce R. McConkie said they're in control. These brethren agree with each other. We got to get on board and start agreeing with what our prophets are saying. Blah, blah, blah. He is guiding the governments as far as the Lord will permit him. That is why there's so much strife, turmoil, and confusion all over the earth. One mastermind is governing the nations. It is not the President of the United States. It's not the king or government of England or any other land. It is Satan himself. He said that in the Doctrines of Salvation. Boy, I bet you're pretty sorry you came tonight. I want to try and break this up and make it a little humorous, but it is a serious subject, and it's not pretty. Now, I'm going to stick with this one for a while. There's a lot of information here that I'm going to share with you. First Presidency gave a message of the First Presidency to the church in October 1942. And it was Heber J. Grant, J. Reuben Clark Jr., and David O. McKay. Here's what they said. Satan is making war against the very foundations upon which society, government, and religion rest. He plans to destroy freedom. And I want you to remember these next three. Economic, political, and religious. Economic freedom, political freedom, and religious freedom. He plans on destroying all of them. And I'll show you in the next slide what pertains to that. And to set up in place thereof the greatest, most widespread, and most complete tyranny that has ever oppressed men. He is working under such perfect disguise that many do not recognize either him or his methods. And I'm going to show you a slide that shows the truth of that. He comes as a thief in the night. He is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I'm going to show you another slide that shows you a perfect and exact fulfillment of that. A wolf in sheep's clothing. Without their knowing it, the people are being urged down paths that lead only to destruction. Now, he plans to destroy freedom, economic, political, and religious. In my investigations over the years, I have found that there are three main branches or arms to this great secret combination. There are financial organizations, there are political organizations, and there are religious organizations set up to destroy financial, political, and religious liberty. I have found that there is not one organization or one person who is head of it all, except for Satan, but he's non-mortal. There's not one mortal person or one organization that is over everything. Rather, there is a whole bunch of different organizations. There are dozens, maybe hundreds of organizations that work together in a loose confederation, and they are divided into these three main groups. Now, I want to spend just a little time on this. I have another presentation that goes into only the financial arm of this organization, and it takes a long time to explain that. It takes a whole evening. Another lecture of mine goes into the political arm of this secret combination, and another lecture goes into the religious arm of this combination. That right there by that symbol by the political, that's supposed to be the victory, V for victory sign. That's the only thing I could see that I could find that is political in nature. But there are three main arms to this great combination. And in each of these arms, there are dozens of organizations. Now, in financial, I'll just give you a slight overview of each one of them. In the financial, the main kind of organization is central banks. Central banks of the world are not government organizations. Every country has them. We have one, and it's called the Federal Reserve. It is not a government institution, even though it has the word federal in the name. It is a private, stock-owned lending institution, a bank that lends money to governments. You can't get a loan from them. They loan money to governments. Sometimes they will loan money to large corporations, multinational corporations, but that's about it. These are the financial end of this combination, and those guys are real bloodsuckers. They have gotten our government into debt to them, and our government can't make a move without the Federal Reserve. They are much more powerful than you have been led to believe in the media. In the political arm, there are a whole bunch of organizations. I'll just talk about one of them, the Council on Foreign Relations. How many have ever heard of the Council on Foreign Relations? Oh, well then, forget it. We'll go on to the next one. Maybe the best question is, how many have not heard of the Council on Foreign Relations? One, two, three. Out. No. If you don't know them by now, by golly, you can't be in here. No. I'm just kidding. Council on Foreign Relations is a group that a non-constitutional group that controls our presidency from behind the scenes. There are sister organizations to this organization, and they are found in every nation of the world. There is a sister organization in England that runs the government of England from behind the scenes. There's a sister organization in Canada. In every nation, they have their own organization, and they all work together. In the religious aspect of it, there is a religion that these people go by. There is a god that they worship. There is there are doctrines that they believe in, tenets, beliefs, and they have their own god that they believe in. And let me tell you, I'll give you a clue, it's not our god. The richest, most powerful people in this world practice the religion called Luciferianism. And I'll let it rest right there. Okay. Now, I'm going back to the previous slide. He is a wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm going to show you a literal fulfillment of that. You're going to like this. Yeah, right. Okay. In 1884, I need to take a drink. In 1884, in Sussex, England, a bunch of British intellectuals got together and formed a society called the Fabian Society. They were socialists, and they wanted to use their power to change the world to become socialist. Now, they started this organization in a house in Sussex, England, and it was the house of Beatrice and Sidney Webb. Now, up in the upper right quadrant there, you can see these two guys are pounding on a globe there. See, they have the hammers over their heads. They're pounding on a globe. In other words, they're trying to shape the world to fit their own desires. They're going to change the world to suit them. The guy on the right is Sidney Webb. The guy on the left is George Bernard Shaw, one of the founders of the Fabian Society. The guy on the left in the upper left quadrant is Bertrand Russell. He is fanning the bellows, doing the bellows of the fire for this anvil, you know. That's an anvil there in the middle. On the bottom, you can see a bunch of disciples of the Fabian Society kneeling in prayer. You can see their arms in prayer, and they're on their knees. But they're not praying to a god. They're praying to a stack of books. And I couldn't make it any clearer than this, but all of those books are books on atheism, communism, socialism, humanism, and any other evolution, anything that has to do with the denial of God. Some of those books, you can't read them here, but some of the books were, for instance, Das Kapital by Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto. The Origin of the Species by Charles Darwin. Other socialist books, I can't remember the names, but there was Plato's Republic, a bunch of these Man is God type of books. are what is featured there, and they're all praying to him. This guy on the lower left-hand quadrant, he has his hands up like this. That is H.G. Wells. He joined the Fabian Society a few years after it was founded, and he quit it. He quit the Fabian Society because they weren't forceful enough. They believed in evolution through democratic means, and by brainwashing everybody, they're going to get everybody to go along with them through democratic, peaceful means. That's what they wanted to do. He didn't like that. He said, that's not forceful enough. I believe the communists have it right. We should force it down everybody's throat. So he quit the Fabian Society, and that's what it means. He's standing up there, and his hands are, oh, I'm getting out of here. I can't stand this. He's getting out of there. But the whole point of this stained glass window, and by the way, it is still in existence to this day. People can go there and take pictures. The house of Sidney and Beatrice Webb turned it into the national headquarters for the Fabian Society. And it's there in existence to this day. Up there, see those two guys who are pounding on up in the upper right quadrant there? Those two guys are pounding on the world. Right in between them there, in a triangle shape, is the logo of the Fabian Society. And that's what I want to concentrate on. This is a blow-up of that logo. It shows a flagpole with a flag there with FS for Fabian Society. And it shows this animal, this black animal, holding up the flagpole. And on his back, he has strapped onto his back another animal, a white-colored animal. Now, I know there is somebody, I know you know what that means. Tell us what that means. A wolf in sheep's clothing. The Fabian Society bragged about it. They bragged that they were deceivers, liars. They're wolves in sheep's clothing, and that's their logo. And to this day, you can go down there if you were ever in Sussex, England. You knew the address. I don't. But that logo is there. They brag how they are wolves in sheep's clothing, and that is a literal fulfillment of what President Grant said about these evil people being wolves in sheep's clothing. They brag about it. This gives you a little bit different view of what really is going on. Now, I don't know about you, but that kind of mentality is kind of akin to a criminal mentality. Someone who brags about their evil, who brags about their iniquity. Gee, that's what Cain did. When he killed his brother Abel, he gloried in his wickedness, and he says, surely I am free. Now my brother's flocks will fall into my hands. He bragged about and gloried in his wickedness. And these people do too. On the surface, they seem just to be nice, kind neighbors and stuff like that. They are not. It takes a very different mindset than what we're used to. But this is the way they think. This is the way they are. Now, before I go on, I want to talk to you about a young man that I met a few years ago. His name was Michael Merritt. Did you ever meet him, Kelly? You never had the chance. I'm going to tell you the story of Michael Merritt. You may want to take notes on this. He is the grandson of Evelyn de Rothschild. He is also a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Considering the background of the Rothschilds, that is incredible. I'll let you know how incredible it is as I go on. He was baptized into the church at the age of 9. He went on a mission to Russia. And after both before and after his mission, he was approached by his grandfather, Evelyn, to come and work for him in London. Evelyn de Rothschild, until either last year or 2 years ago, Evelyn de Rothschild was the head of the London branch of the Rothschild banking dynasty. The London branch was the most powerful. It is the most powerful of all the Rothschild family groups. They got groups in, they got a family branch in France, and they got one in Italy and one in Germany and various countries. This was the most powerful of all of them. It was started by Nathan Rothschild, and he practically took over the whole economy of England in one afternoon during the Napoleonic Wars, but I'm not going to go into that. But nevertheless, he wanted his grandson, Michael Merritt, to come and head the Rothschild family group. And for a while he did. He helped his grandfather. He learned the central banking business. He learned a lot of things from his grandfather about the business. And he also learned from his grandfather about the family religion. And the God they worship is not the God we worship. It is true that the Rothschilds are Jewish by blood. They are not Jewish by religion. Anyway, when he was introduced into this family religion, he went so far into it, and then he rebelled. His upbringing as a Latter-day Saint would not allow him to do the things that they ask you to do in their rites and rituals. And he rebelled, and he quit. And he was cut off by his grandfather from that day to this. To this day, he has no money from him. He lives in Riverside, California. Would you like to see a picture of him? I can't hear you. This is Michael Merritt. He had a little picture on the internet, and I can't blow it up anymore because it'll get too grainy, but that's him. Now, I learned about him when he was in the BYU Hawaii campus out in Hawaii. He was going to school there. I learned about him, and I told Dr. Skousen about him, and he got young Michael. He's about 28, 29 now. He's still quite young. He got Michael to come and live with him. Michael lived in Dr. Skousen's house for a year, and I had the rare privilege of talking to him extensively about his family, about things he went through and what his family did to him and for him. I'll give you one little instance. When he was on his mission for the church in Russia, he was in the town of Sarna, Russia, when a great big black limousine drove up. He was walking down the street with his companion, and a big black limousine drove up and stopped right beside him. And a guy in a black suit got out and said, "Get in." And he knew who they were. They were from his grandfather, Evelyn de Rothschild. So he got into this limousine, and his companion was going on, "What's going on here?" You see, he'd never told his companion that he was a grandson of a Rothschild. His companion was going crazy. He thought they was going to drive off with him or something. Anyway, this guy said to him, "I have been authorized by your grandfather to offer you $100 million if you'll quit the Mormon Church, quit this mission, and come back and work for your grandfather. $100 million. And let me tell you, to the Rothschilds, that's pocket change. That's chump change. That's nothing. Michael Merritt has a trust fund waiting for him. Whenever he decides to quit the church, he has a trust fund in the multi-billions of dollars. He said he estimated it about a year or two ago to be worth around $50 to $60 billion right now. It's waiting for him. But he won't deny the truth. He won't deny the church. Anyway, I knew from some previous information that I had that the reverse seal on our money, that's what's on our $1 bill, the reverse seal on our money was the seal of the Illuminati. You see, the Rothschilds helped found the Illuminati. The Illuminati is a secret society that came into existence on May 1st, 1776 in Bavaria, Germany. Adam Weishaupt was the founder, and it was funded by Mayer Amschel Rothschild, the first Rothschild. His name used to be Mayer Amschel Bauer, but he changed it to Rothschild. He was the original. They had a logo. They had a seal. And somebody told me from a story that I heard, a man by the name of John Todd Collins, who was a grand druid in witchcraft, and he was also a member of the Illuminati. He had seen the seal, and he said that this was the seal of the Illuminati, and I knew this for years. So I asked Michael, because of his background, he was a Rothschild, and his family was in the Illuminati. I said, is this the seal of the Illuminati? And he said, from what I remember, I did this little email with him about 2 months ago. From what I remember, and it's been a while, the seal is similar, but not exactly the same. It does have the pyramid with the all-seeing eye and the 13 steps, but I don't really recall. So I thought to myself, well, if it's similar, well, I do know, you see, there's only two things I know about history, and that was that Columbus discovered Ohio in 1776, and that Joan of Arc is Noah's wife. Other than that, I don't have a clue. But anyway, I do recall that in American history, the seal that we have today, the obverse with the eagle and the reverse with the unfinished pyramid, those seals are not the same. They have not been the same throughout American history. They started out quite different from what they are today. And Congress has from time to time appointed commissions and committees to oversee the changing of the seal and to change it and make it look better. So I said to myself, well, if that's not the precise seal of the Illuminati, maybe one of the earlier renditions would be, before Congress changed it to this. This was changed to its present form around 1933, 34, and they put it on I think it came out first in the 1935 $1 bills. I don't remember. It was about that time. So I said, maybe another one. One of the early iterations would be the precise seal of the Illuminati. So I started grousing around, and I found this seal. This is the 1887 reverse seal of the United States. It used to be the seal that we used. And I asked him, is this the seal of the Illuminati? And he said, that is the precise seal of the Illuminati. It was even more recognizable in gold. Somehow they got their seal on our money. Now, I want you to look at this. Over the head of it, over the all-seeing eye, you can barely make it out. It says Anuit Septis, or I can't pronounce that exactly right. But that's the same wording as is on the top of there. That the translation, that's Latin, and then translated, that means he hath favored our undertakings or our job. That means God. God hath favored our undertakings, not our God. Okay, then there's the all-seeing eye. There's the unfinished pyramid with 13 levels. And there's the date, 1776. I want to call your attention to that. This is the seal of the Illuminati. So that date means May 1st, 1776. It does not mean July 4th. They're not going to put the birth of our nation on their seal. That 1776 on the bottom there refers to May 1st, 1776, Bavaria, Germany. On the bottom there is Novus Ordo Seclorum. That means Literally translated, that means new order of the ages. It does not mean new world order. However, seclorum has the same root meaning as our English word secular. And our English word secular means worldly or of the world. So if you wanted a rough translation of it, it could mean new world order. But the precise translation is new order of the ages. Now that is the seal of the Illuminati, and it is the precursor to this. So when you look at the date on the bottom of this pyramid, what date do you think it's talking about? 1776. Every American, practically every American, will look at that and say, oh, that means July 4th, 1776, the birth of our nation. But it doesn't. It is referring to the date on its predecessor, May 1st, 1776. This is the seal of the Illuminati. Or to be more precise, this is the modified seal of the Illuminati, because it has all of the symbolism, all of the objects, all of the wording is exactly the same as the original Illuminati seal. So, what? Who cares? Many people will look at that and say, oh, big deal. It means a lot to me. I want you to read this. Now, what does that got to do with secret combinations? I have, in the years that I've studied this, I'll have people that will come up to me with the same mental frame of mind as is portrayed on that sign. They're very good people. But they have this blind spot, this attitude, you can't trespass on my mental world view. You can't do that. And there is one thing that all of them have in common that I have noticed. Not one of them has actually studied conspiracy theory. Not one. And yet they have this absolute mindset that they are absolutely correct and there is no conspiracy and there can be no conspiracy. And if you try and tell them there is a conspiracy, boy, they'll shoot you. Now, to show you that kind of thought process, that mental attitude, I'm going to show you a letter. When I wrote my book, Hiding in Plain Sight, I sent the manuscript to the first publisher, and he accepted it. And he wrote me back a letter of acceptance. Now, I have to tell you that it is a letter of acceptance because when I read it to you, you might believe otherwise. Here it is. Here's what he said. Thank you for sending us your work about secret combinations in the last days. We have published several books like this, and one of them has done very well, as I think yours will. There's a large group of Mormons out there who seem to do better and be happier if they think an enemy is poised at the door to destroy them. It feels good to be afraid, I suppose. I have written books and articles, sometimes very controversial, for many years. And nobody from a secret world organization ever tried to censor me, but then again, I'm just a small town guy from Utah. I'd like to publish your book just to see if someone rich and powerful will appear out of nowhere and order us to cease publication. That's a letter of acceptance? Jeez. Oh, my goodness gracious. Now, the man who wrote this happens to be a very well-known Mormon author. And I could tell you his name, and you'd go, oh, wow, is that who that is? But I won't. I'm not going to tell you. It will do no good to drag people down or to put people down. You know, I looked at that letter, and I laughed. And I said, I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that in my presentations. And that's the actual letter. Okay. So I just want to tell you, this is the kind of mindset. And I know why they believe this, because over the years, the news media of the United States was bought by these people. And I'm going to tell you a little secret here. I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Tomorrow morning, I want you to go turn on your TV at 7 o'clock and listen to the Today Show And this is what they'll say. I turn it on. I listen to. I want to see what the enemy says. The Today Show says this. They say, this is the Today Show featuring Matt Lauer and Katie Couric. We're broadcasting from NBC World News headquarters at Studio 1A, Rockefeller Center. The people who run this world control all of the major news media. Now, notice I said major. I did not say all of the news media. They control all of the major news media. They control, have the majority of voting blocks of the voting stock in ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Turner, Fox. They own the controlling stock in all of them. They control the major book publishers. They control the major newspapers. They control the same group of people. Now, they have front organizations, but when you trace it right back, it comes back to the Rockefellers and the Morgans. The Rothschilds own Reuters news agency. They own the major news media of the world. And they will always reflect, this news media will always reflect the views of the owners. And the one thing that they tell them above all else is to don't talk about no conspiracy, because there ain't none, and you can't have it. You can't do that. There ain't no conspiracy, so don't publish something or report on something that doesn't exist. And so the news media, which is owned by them, dutifully does their duty, and they keep conspicuously silent about this. They don't control all the media. They don't control all the news outlets, but they control the major ones. And it is the major ones that forms the opinions of most Americans. Therefore, when the news media says there ain't no conspiracy and everybody who thinks there is some kind of nut or kook or right-wing radical, America will parrot and puppet that line. I'm going to tell you this right now. The names radical, right-wing kook, fringe element thinking, extremist, radical right-wing extremist, all of these are names that were deliberately cooked up by think tanks, given to the news media and broadcast. Right-wing militia's another one. Yes, he said, what's the word, xenophobe? Now, I want to tell you, this is the way it is. So that's why those names circulate out there, because it was a deliberate brainwash. We're supposed to think that there is no conspiracy. We're supposed to look at the image of the world that they portray and say, that's the way things are. And it is not that way. To tell you, I'm going to tell you the Olivia de Havilland story. You're going to love this. This is the story of a person who had that same mental attitude that I talked to you about. And she changed it. She is the lady who portrayed Melanie Wilkes in Gone with the Wind. That sweet, loving, just, you know, she's so kind in the movie and everything like that. The real Olivia is a little different, and I'll show you that. Here's her story. In the 1940s, they had a lot of the Communist Party infiltrated a lot of American institutions, and the entertainment industry was not accepted. They went after people in the entertainment industry, and they contacted Olivia de Havilland. She's an idealist. I greatly admire her. After hearing this story, I just thought she's a great gal. They contacted her and they told her the following spiel. They said, look, the Communist Party is only working for the democratization of America. We want to help the downtrodden proletariat masses to be able to enjoy life better and enjoy the fruits of the capitalist society and be able to participate in it more. We're just working for the masses. And she followed that bull, hook, line, and sinker. She started to contribute money. She contributed $10,000 a month to the communist cause. Back in the 1940s or 50s when this happened, that was a lot of money. That would be at least 10 times that amount in today's money. That's a lot of money to plow into a cause, but she was an idealist. She really believed it. She took that and believed it. The only problem is, when these communists who recruited her for her financial assistance, when they met in secret, when she wasn't around, here's what they said. We got this milk cow that we can milk anytime we want. We have this money tree that we can pluck anytime. She's one of those decadent American capitalists, and we're suckering her out for everything we can bilk her from. When we take over America and destroy the government and set up a communist government in America, we'll take people like her and send them out to Siberia. But for now, we need suckers like her. They talked about that. They said things like that behind her back. And the reason I know that is because they were secretly being taped. They didn't know it. They were being taped by the FBI. They met in a certain place, same time, and they had microphones set up there. And they were being taped by the FBI. And they taped so much of that they found out, they're playing her for a sucker. Now, the thing is, W. Cleon Skousen was an agent, and he was assigned to the Olivia de Havilland case. So he began to think to himself, wait a minute, hold on there. If she knew what they were saying about her behind her back, I wonder if she would contribute all this money. So he got together a short 30-minute tape that took all of these many, many hours of taped conversation and put them together to show her exactly what they were saying about her behind her back. And they went to her house. He and an agent went to Olivia de Havilland's mansion. And they knocked on the door, and the maid came to the door, and she said, hello, may I help you? And he says, we're the FBI, and we'd like to talk to Miss de Havilland. And she says, okay, let me announce you. So she went way in the back of the house there, and she told him that the FBI would like to talk to her at the front door. And they could hear from the front door, they could hear her say, what the hell are those guys doing there? And this is Melanie Wilkes. Nice, sweet Melanie Wilkes. They just want to talk to you, madam. Okay. So she came out to the front, and he says, what do you want? And they says, well, we're with the FBI, and we'd like to know why you're contributing so much money to the communist cause. And she says, I can do anything with my money I want. Now get the hell out of here. This is nice, sweet Melanie Wilkes. They talked with her and argued, and she was just arguing and just so belligerent with them. And finally, Agent Skousen said to her, now look, we have taped conversations of what these communists, your friends, are saying about you behind your back. You should listen and see what they really think of you when you're not around. And that took her aback. That made her stop and think. And so she says, well, okay, I'll listen to it. So she took the tape, she went into another room, put it on her tape recorder. And it was a 30-minute presentation, or a 30-minute tape. After 3-4 minutes, she came out there and she says, why those SOBs? I'm never going to give any money to them again. This was sweet Melanie Wilkes. Oh, that was so funny. And she says, I'm not gonna have nothing to do with these guys ever again. And then Agent Skousen said to her, now wait a minute, let's consider this. Suppose now that you went back to one last meeting of this communist cell and you told them there's a stool pigeon in the midst here. One of you guys is talking to the FBI because I found out that someone has told the FBI that I'm contributing all this money to the communist cause. And I'm not going to give you any more money until you tell me who it is that's the stool pigeon. So she went back there, and when they had their very next meeting, she went into that meeting and she slammed her fist on the podium and says, there's a rat in the middle of this this group here. There is a stool pigeon who's telling the FBI that I'm contributing money to your cause, and until you tell me who it is, I'm not contributing any more money to you. And she stormed out of there. The point was, there was no stool pigeon. It was taped. It was microphones, hidden microphones. There wasn't, nobody was a stool pigeon. But the effect of it was that they started, the FBI was listening in on this very conversation. After she left, they started accusing each other of being stool pigeons. They started pointing fingers at, are you the rat? I mean, we need this money. We got to have this money. You're the rat. No, you are. No, you. They started turning against each other. And the effect of it was that they totally destroyed each other's faith in each other, and that communist cell was dismantled, which was exactly what the FBI wanted. And that's the Olivia de Havilland story. And I have a great respect for her because she had this same mental attitude. This is the way the world is, and it can't be any other way. And you better not tell me that it's different or I'll shoot you. But then she found out the truth and she changed. She's an idealist. She's kind of like Saul of Tarsus. He was totally against the Christian faith when it came out, and he was totally dedicated to its destruction. But when he found the truth, he did an 180 degrees turnabout and became one of its strongest defenders when he learned the truth. And that was Olivia de Havilland. When she learned the truth, she became an ardent supporter of our Constitution and our American government. Well, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. What does this conspiracy say about itself? Let's take a look here now. It is now approaching 8:30. We're going to have a little break, about a 10-minute break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss this conspiracy. Before we do, I'm going to just introduce you to these two gentlemen. This the guy on the left here, or no, you're right, is David Rockefeller. This man here is the grandfather of Michael Merritt. This is Evelyn de Rothschild. This is what really gets me about the conspiracy, is that they actually brag about what they do. It's in secret to themselves, but they make no bones about what they're doing. Okay, what does the conspiracy say about itself? Well, let's find out. This gentleman here, down at the bottom, he says Arnold Toynbee. He belonged to a secret organization called the Round Table. The Round Table took its name from the legend of King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table. They organized a Round Table and a secret society. The founder of it was Cecil Rhodes, the guy who founded the De Beers Mining Company in South Africa. They named the country Rhodesia after him. They subsequently changed it to Zimbabwe, but he was Cecil Rhodes was the guy who founded the De Beers Mining Company with Rothschild money and the Consolidated Gold Fields of South Africa. Anyway, Arnold Toynbee, Cecil Rhodes, Alfred Milner, and others founded the Round Table. The Round Table is part of the Council on Foreign Relations that I already discussed. It is the executive committee, and every country has a round table in the executive committee of all of these institutes of international relationships that I've already talked about. The Council on Foreign Relations controls our government from behind the scenes, and the round table is part of the executive committee, which is over it. In other words, it's a circle within a circle, or a secret within a secret. There's a secret organization that's within the secret organization of the Council on Foreign Relations. Here's what he said in 1931. He said, "We are at present working discreetly with all our might to wrest this mysterious force called sovereignty out of the clutches of the local nation states of the world. All the time we are denying with our lips what we are doing with our hands." And I'm going to show you how literally that is true. Now I'm going to tell you another story. This is the story of Mark Skousen. Mark Skousen is a nephew of W. Klein. I got a lot of stories from him. And the reason is that when W. Klein Skousen read my story, my book, Hiding in Plain Sight, he said to me, "Ken, I want you to come and work for me." And it has been my distinct honor and privilege to work with W. Klein Skousen in his home for 4.5 years up until he passed away. I organized all of his personal files so that he could copy them off on a DVD or on a DVD. He wanted to copy off all of his personal files for everybody to see. And he has it. He has the master of it. He has never duplicated them for general use, but he has them. He has allowed me to rearrange his library. He has allowed me to do a lot of personal work for him, like look for rare books, do research. He has the committee files. Remember about I told you about the Reese Committee in 1953 that was studying the foundations? He has their personal papers of the Reese Committee. He became acquainted with Norman Dodd, the chief investigator, and got those papers. That's why he knows what he does about the Reese Committee and about Norman Gaither, who said, "We're working under directions of the White House to merge with the Soviet Union." That's why he knows that. Comes from the primary sources of the Reese Committee. And he allowed me to go through them, and I went through all of them. There are 8 boxes full of papers. Most of them are just letters and correspondence, a lot of junk, but there are gems in there of information. And I have been the privilege to go through those very things. Now I'm going to show you. Anyway, Mark Skousen, he wrote these books on financial independence and how to work, get real estate money, use real estate to make money and so forth. He's a nephew of W. Klein. He was offered a job at Columbia University in New York. And he went there and taught. And while he was there, he happened to be in the Rockefeller Center. He went up to the 17th floor of the Rockefeller Tower there, and that's where David Rockefeller has his personal offices. And Rockefeller wasn't there that day, but he asked the staff, "Are you guys part of a conspiracy? Do you guys try to take over the world? I've heard all my uncle and I've heard people talk about how you guys and the Rothschilds are trying to take over the world. Is this true? Is there any truth to this?" And they said, "This is absolutely false. That is so wrong. You can't believe what extremists are saying. Don't take any credence. It's all a lie. Don't believe it." And he swallowed it. He called up his uncle, W. Klein. He says, "Uncle, you have been telling us for years that there's this conspiracy headed by the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and all these big banking families. You've been telling us for years that they're part of a great big conspiracy. Well, I talked to them and they told me no. I know that you're not telling. I know that you're not right." He's going, Oh, my goodness, you talked to them, and they told you, oh, boy. It was really funny for him. He had to take his son down, or his nephew down, and reassess, help him reassess his brainwashing. Anyway, now, I say all that to lead up to the very next slide. David Rockefeller wrote his own autobiography in 2002. It's called Memoirs. Okay? On page 405 of his own autobiography, in his words, here's what he says. For more than a century, ideological extremists, you right-wing kooks, at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidents to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe that we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. Now, if you think I'm lying to you, if you think I'm deceiving you and I'm not reporting to you exactly what he said, then I'm going to give you a little assignment. You go to any Barnes & Noble bookstore. You go to any Borders bookstore, any major bookstore. Go to Amazon.com and order it. David Rockefeller's Memoirs, page 405. It's right there. I'm quoting exactly what he said. The thing that gets me about this statement is his arrogance. People who tell the world that he is a conspirator, that he's part of a secret cabal, people who say this are political or ideological extremists. Those are his words right up there. If you tell the world that I am working in this secret cabal or this secret organization to overthrow the United States, if you tell the world that, you're an extremist. It's true, but if you mention it, you're an extremist. So people who tell the truth are extremists, but people like Rockefeller who want to reshape the world to make themselves masters and make the rest of us slaves, they're just good old guys doing what comes naturally, and that's okay. But if you report on them and tell the world that they're doing it and tell the truth, you're an extremist. Black is white, night is day, good is evil. These guys have everything exactly screwed up. The extremist is the person who wants to make themselves the master of the rest of us and say that we don't have the intellectual capacity to rule ourselves. They want to rule us. Those are the extremists, and the patriots are the people who tell the truth. This is incredible. Time for a little humor break. The Indians are standing on the shore there, looking out into Cape Cod Bay. One of them says, we need better immigration laws. They see the Mayflower out there. Profiling is politically incorrect. Besides, they pose no real threat to us. But that touches on the immigration issue, and that's a whole nother ball of wax. The immigration policy of the United States now is to destroy the borders of the United States and to allow unlimited immigration. And by destroying the immigration laws and by destroying immigration quotas and things like that and getting rid of that and let people move wherever they want, then you could come up with the question, well, if you're going to do all that, why have political borders at all? Why don't we just merge into one great, big, happy world government? That is what is going on behind the Trilateral Commission. They are trying to economically unite the world into one economic unit, thereby destroying the political borders as a consequence. They have many ways of doing this, and this is the one of the ways they're trying, and they are behind NAFTA and CAFTA and all of the other laws that are aimed at destroying our sovereignty. How many know about the book Tragedy and Hope? Most of you do. Tragedy and Hope was written by a man by the name of Carol Quigley, who was a professor of history at Georgetown University. This is for those who don't know. And Tragedy, he wrote this. The book itself is kind of a history of Western Civ. That's basically it. It's a history of the Western civilization from about the time of Columbus to when it was printed in 1966. But this history of Western civilization is unlike any history that you will ever read about in any Western Civ class in college. They won't ever use this book as a textbook, because this tells the real history of Western civilization, tells exactly how the Rothschilds set up central banks throughout Europe to govern the governments of the European nations from behind the scenes financially, tells about how the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds got together to set up the Federal Reserve in America, tells how they set up the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs to govern the political decisions of their respective governments. It talks about also one other aspect. Someone during the break asked me, what can we do about this? Who was that? What can we do about all this? There you are. I'll tell you one thing that you can do, how you can fight, the best way that you can fight this. President Benson once said that our Constitution is hanging by a thread, and that thread consists of our franchise to vote. You see, the vote that we have is the only power that we have over the politicians who are the puppets of these people. It's the only power we have, and if we vote right, if we learn how to vote correctly, then we can do something that will move this country back into the right direction. And what is the right direction? We need to restore the Constitution to its spiritual foundation and to the Constitution as it was envisioned by the founding fathers. That is the correct thing to do. It is that Constitution that the founders knew that made America the greatest nation on the earth. It was that Constitution. The Constitution that we follow today is a shadow of what it was. We pay tribute to it in name only. It is no longer the Constitution of the United States. It has been changed enough that it no longer follows the direction of small, limited federal government that the founders envisioned. It is now, by anybody's admission, it is now a huge monopolizing force grabbing more power all the time. They never envisioned for this great big behemoth called the American government to be as large as it is today. They never wanted that. By keeping it small, that kept people's liberties intact. Kept people's liberties intact. We need to return to that. And the way you do it is vote right. You should never vote for anyone that wants to vote for more government, bigger government. I'll tell you one thing right here. I'm gonna get something out here and I'll show you what I mean. I received in the mail a little while ago a flyer from Rob Bishop. Now, I don't have anything against him personally. And you, this is from his own office. You get them in the mail all the time from Jim Matheson and from Orrin Hatch, all of our congressional delegation. This came from Rob Bishop, and I had it laminated because it says on the back here what he stands for. Medicare. I voted for the new prescription drug benefit under Medicare to allow seniors access to more affordable medicines. Where does it say that specifically in the Constitution? It's not there. The founders would have stood, would have stirred in their graves if they had known that anybody, that the government would try and take over Medicare prescription drug programs for seniors that gives the government power over people. The United States Supreme Court in 1942 said that whatever the government funds, the government controls. Social Security, we must guarantee that current and soon-to-be retirees will continue to get the benefits they deserve while saving the program for future generations. Homeland Security, taxes, immigration, education, go right down the list. The founders never envisioned anything like that. Constitutional government means limited government, and let the people take the control of their lives into their own hands. It means no more federal handouts, no more federal aid to farmers or to big businesses or to Social Security recipients. It means a return to the limited government that they knew. Our government knows the golden rule, which is he who has the gold makes the rules. You want to be controlled by federal government? Then ask for a subsidy. They'll control you. They'll make you their servant. They'll make you dependent on them. We're slaves because we depend so much on government, we can't live without a government subsidy of some kind. The way to get out of it is to return it to constitutional government. There is a small third party in the state of Utah called the Constitution Party. They believe in returning our government to its original role of protector and defender, and then leave the people alone to make their own way. That's what they believe in. And I would urge you to never again vote for anyone, Republican, Democrat, or anyone, who wants more subsidies from the government. For the government will control your lives. I'm passionate about this. This really rocks me. You want to be a slave? Ask for a subsidy. You want to be a man or a woman? You want to be your own person? Then tell the government where to go. Tell them to leave you alone. Never again vote for government subsidies for anything. You use your precious vote to vote for constitutional government, because I have the very firm opinion that in the judgment bar of God, we will have to give account of what we did with his precious constitution that he trusted to us. We're going to have to stand there and say, well, I voted for Rob Bishop or Jim Matheson because he got me all this federal subsidies. Pull the chain, down to hell. I tell you, boy. Next. Yeah, that's the excuse. I have to vote for candidate X because candidate Y is worse, so candidate X is the lesser of two evils. Well, let me tell you something. Voting for the lesser of two evils is still voting for evil. It's like you have Mao Zedong and you have Hitler. Let's see, which candidate, Republican or Democrat? Which one am I going to vote for? Voting for the lesser of two evils is still voting for evil. Don't vote for anyone who will increase the size of government, because they will increase the size of your slavery. Enough said of that. You want to know what to do? Now you know. You vote right. Please. We have to pressure our congressmen to do what we want and vote congressmen in, like people of the Constitution Party, who will demand paper ballots. Where are they doing it? Here in Utah, they have one of the strongest Constitution parties. They're in practically all the states. CPUtah.org is their official website. CPUtah.org. Join the Constitution Party. I urge you, desert the Republican and Democratic parties en masse. I have a presentation that comes up, And if you'll come and attend, I'll tell you, I'll give you all the quotations of how the two major parties are controlled by these same forces. You see, they can try to control all sides of every question. They can't do it totally, but they try to control the major major sides of every question. So they will control the conservatives and the liberals through the people. Like, for instance, Newt Gingrich. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He is on the right wing of the Republican Party. Ted Kennedy is on the Council on Foreign Relations. He's on the left end. Dianne Feinstein, Hillary Clinton, Governor Lovett, the publisher of the Deseret Morning News, or the John Hughes, member of the Council on Foreign Relations. George Bush is in another secret society called the Skull and Bones. But they work in conjunction with either. Okay, let's go on. Carol Quigley was a professor at Georgetown University. It was his responsibility to draft people into this into the Rhodes Scholarships, into the Roundtable Council on Foreign Relations type of this secret society. And he had a young student by the name of William Jefferson Clinton, who he drafted in. And Clinton, when he became the Democratic presidential hopeful in 1992 to run for as president, when they voted for him and he became the official Democratic Party candidate for president, he got up there and in his acceptance speech he says, "Hey, I had my world view taught me by Carol Quigley, Georgetown University." He drafted that young man. Did you guys read all this? He examined its papers and secret records. My chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. That's what he says. He bragged about it. He was part of it. This book ought to be on every bookshelf in America. You can get it off of Amazon.com. Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, $40. Get it. Look in it. Go to the index and look up Rockefellers and Rothschilds, central banks. Look up Council on Foreign Relations, Royal Institute for International Affairs, all these. And you'll see all of this. And you'll also see a quote there how he says how they control both political parties. They brag about it. On the New York Times, April 9th, 1902, front page. Talks about Cecil Rhodes, who just recently died. He died in 1902. And they had a front page article about him where then they put in his last will. Now, he had many wills during his life. His last will talked about his establishment of a secret society called the Round Table, which we've already discussed. And he said this: "This is a frank, powerful explanation of Mr. Rhodes' views on America and Great Britain. And it for the first time sets forth his own inmost thoughts. Perhaps they can best be summarized as an argument in favor of the organization of a secret society on the lines of the Jesuit order for the promotion of the peace and welfare of the world," yeah, right, "and the establishment of an American-British Federation. The only thing feasible to carry out this idea is a secret society gradually absorbing the wealth of the world," and they're doing that, "to be devoted to such an object." On the front page of the New York Times, you can go to the Marriott Library or the BYU, the Harold B. Lee Library down there and look at the microfilms of old New York Times. That's exactly what I did. Went up to U of U, and there it is, right there. Front page. Norman Dodd was the chief investigator of the Reese Committee. He went to Rowan Gaither, who was the president of the Ford Foundation at the time. And he went in there, and he was investigating the foundations because people had complained to the Reese Committee that their children were being brainwashed into socialism and communism by liberal professors in the universities. And the Reese Committee investigated and found out that the major foundations were giving grants to universities across the country on certain conditions, that they hire liberal professors who praised socialism and put down the American Founding Fathers and the Constitution. They made these grants to all the prestigious universities in America, Harvard and Princeton and Yale and University of Chicago, some of the best universities in America. And they found out that they were doing this. And as a matter of fact, he went to meet with the president of the Ford Foundation, and here's what he said. "We, the Ford Foundation, operate here under directives which emanate from the White House. The substance of the directives under which we operate is that we shall use our grant-making power to alter life in the United States so that we can comfortably be merged with the Soviet Union." So that's why the professors were teaching socialism and communism in schools, because they had to, because the grants that they received from these powerful universities, these powerful foundations, directed that they do so. Norman Dodd said, "When I heard that, I nearly fell off my chair." And then he said, "Well, I guess you can do whatever you want with your money, but you deserve to let the American people know exactly what you're doing. Are you willing to tell the American people this?" And he said, "Mr. Dodd, we will never tell that to the American people. That is something we will never do." When you're a kid, you have your mother tell you, "Eat your vegetables so you won't have something wrong, so won't we have a physical deformity when you grow old." Well, that's what happened to me because I didn't eat my vegetables. Got to have a little humor in here. Now, here's a statement by David Rockefeller again. He was in front of a meeting of the Trilateral Commission, which he helped form in 1973. And he made this admission. He said it in secret, only for their ears, but somehow this one got out. They can't keep a secret of everything. "We are grateful to the Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years." That's why they say no talkie-talkie about this conspiracy. That's why they tell you to be quiet. "But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. The supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries." The arrogance. "We, the powerful, know better than you what's good for you." Can you believe that? And yet this is exactly where they are. "We shall have world government, whether or not you like it, by conquest or consent." He said that to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1950. James Warburg is a member, not only the Council on Foreign Relations, but he is one of the Warburg family. Warburg family is one of the richest and most powerful of the banking dynasties. They're just under the Rothschilds in power. "We are not going to achieve a new world order without paying for it in blood, as well as in words and money." That was said by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Foreign Affairs is the periodical, the official periodical of the Council on Foreign Relations. You can go to any Barnes & Noble bookstore, any big bookstore, and buy a copy. It's in most libraries. It's online. They publish it. It is known, but not very many Americans know about it or what it really says. But it's there. It's their official publication. It has been said that if you want to know what the American presidency is going to do next year, read Foreign Affairs this year. Then in 2002, let me show you. I got it right here, as a matter of fact. In March or April of 2002, I'm going to let you, come here.
Next stop, Baghdad. Kenneth Pollack makes the case for invasion.
March and April of 2002, Foreign Affairs published this article by one of their members, Kenneth Pollack, and he made the case for invasion of Iraq. Next stop, Baghdad. in March of 2002, this came out. And in March of 2003, we invaded Iraq. About a year before we invaded Vietnam, or a year before Lyndon Johnson escalated the war in Vietnam, they came out in foreign affairs and said, we ought to be involved in Vietnam greater than we are. By golly, next year they did it. You want to know what the American presidency does next year? Read Foreign Affairs this year. Any bookstore, you just go on the current events, in the periodicals and magazines, in current events, you'll find it. It's there. They wanted to invade Iraq, and it didn't matter what excuse they came up with. They started it out with the excuse that they've got WMDs, and I think he did. He just took them and shipped them to Syria. I mean, we had months and months and months before we actually invaded. And they took all their weapons of mass destruction and shipped them off to Syria. And the Israeli Mossad knows that they've got them there. They know they're there. He had them. But that's not the point. The point is they wanted to invade Iraq. They wanted to invade Iraq, and weapons of mass destruction is as good an excuse as any. Hussein is a madman. He was. He's no good. He was a tyrant. He was evil to his people. But, you know, you could use that excuse, WMDs, terrorist connections, whatever. Pick an excuse. You want to invade somebody, just pick an excuse. That's what happened. Remember I told you H.G. Wells wrote not only The Time Machine and War of the Worlds. He was a famous science fiction author. I love The Time Machine. It's a great science fiction book. He wrote other books. One of them is called The New World Order. That's the name of the book, The New World Order. It's right there. It's right there in public view. Here's what he said. When the struggle seems to be drifting definitely towards a world social democracy, aka one world government, there may still be great delays and disappointments before it becomes an efficient and beneficent world system. Ha ha. Countless people will hate the New World Order and will die protesting it. When we evaluate its promise, we have to bear in mind the distress of a generation of so or so of malcontents, extremists, many of them quite gallant and graceful-looking people. So we're going to establish a New World Order, and we'll have to kill off a generation of so of malcontents. So what? They're just cannon fodder. They're just grease that will grease the wheels of our tanks as we crush them. That kind of arrogance is so apparent with these people. And here's what Ezra Taft Benson said about that very kind of attitude. Here's what he says. Most of the major ills of the world have been caused by well-meaning people who ignored the principle of individual freedom except as applied to themselves. They want to be masters of the world, and they have all the they want to have all the freedom to do whatever they want, but they're not going to give it to you. And who were obsessed with fanatical zeal to improve the lot of mankind in the mass through some pet formula of their own. The harm done by ordinary criminals, murderers, gangsters, and thieves is negligible in comparison with the agony inflicted upon human beings by the professional do-gooders who attempt to set themselves up as gods and who would ruthlessly force their views on all others with the abiding assurance that the end justifies the means. Henry Weaver wrote the book, The Mainspring of Human Progress. Fantastic book on human freedom. Is that true? I think he wrote that book, but nevertheless, he quotes from him in the book, An Enemy Hath Done This. Time for comic relief. I didn't know about that. It wasn't reported in the newspapers. Okay, what do others say about the conspiracy? There are many people who have come in contact with it who are not necessarily part of it, but they deal with it. And they have found out what it's really like, and a few of them, man, it is amazing. If you're on the outside looking in, it's like looking through a glass darkly, and you have to painstakingly dig out all of the elements that make this conspiracy come to life. You have to make a picture out of all these disparaging pieces. You have to make an image out of it. And it's hard. It takes a lot of time. And you guys are benefiting from the years that I've put into this. If I can pat myself on the back. What do others say about this conspiracy? Let's look at some of them. One of them was a great American, Jesse Helms. People have disparaged this man, but this man knew what he was talking about. You know, he is the only legislator in the world to ever appear before the Security Council of the UN. Now, people have appeared before the Security Council, but they are usually presidents of their countries, or they are diplomats, ambassadors to the UN who are specifically assigned by their country to go there. But he's a legislator. He's a senator. He was a senator. They have never asked anybody like a senator or a member of parliament from Great Britain or the Duma of Russia to ever appear before the UN Security Council. He did. And you know why they asked him? Because he was an inordinate enemy of the New World Order. And he told them at that occasion, this happened about 3 or 4 years ago, around 2000, I think. He said, the American people will never accept the New World Order. But they asked him to come and testify before him. The only senator, the only legislator in the world who ever did that. Here's what he said before the United States Senate. This campaign against the American people, against traditional American culture and values, is systematic psychological warfare. It is orchestrated by a vast array of interests, comprising not only the Eastern establishment, but also the radical left. Among this group, we find the Department of State, the Department of Commerce, the money center banks, the central banks, that is, and multinational corporations, the media, the educational establishment, the entertainment industry, and the large tax-exempt foundations. In other words, he's saying these guys are in cahoots. They're working together. Not only that, Mr. President, a careful examine of what is happening behind the scenes reveals that all of these interests are working in concert with the masters of the Kremlin, the communists, in order to create what some refer to as a New World Order. Private organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Trilateral Commission, the Dartmouth Conference, the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies, these are think tanks, the Atlantic Institute, the Bilderberger Group, serve to disseminate and to coordinate the plans for the so-called New World Order in powerful business, financial, economic, and official circles. How did he live so long? He ate his vegetables. They do assassinate people from time to time. I think that's what they did with Larry McDonald. He was on that flight that got shot down by the Soviet Union, that Korean Airlines flight that supposedly went astray over to Russian territory, and they shot it down. He was on that flight. Now, they do assassinate people from time to time. However, they have to be very discreet about it because they can't just go around killing everybody who opposes them. However, he never presented that much of a threat to them, or they would have. Anyway, one thing I want to tell you about this is that he saw the vision. He saw the vision. All of these things work together. And you want to see proof of that? Next slide, please. David Gumaer, former undercover police intelligence agents who had participated in SDS demonstrations, that is the Students for Democratic Society, remember them from the 60s? They were radical student protesters, and they even had a violent cousin called the Weathermen, who actually advocated and tried for the violent overthrow of the American government. Well, this is the Students for Democratic Society. Well, David Gumaer penetrated them as an intelligent police undercover agent, and he wondered where the money was coming from for all this activity. And soon discovered that it came through radicals via the United Nations. What the heck does the United Nations care about American political agitation? From the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, United Auto Workers, as well as cigar boxes of American money from the Cuban embassy, the communists, the foundations, they're working together, just like Senator Helms said. They corroborate each other. This is not the only thing. And bring it back even more closer to home. That, of course, is W. Cleon Skousen, and that is Eldridge Cleaver. How many of you know the story of Eldridge Cleaver? A number of you. Let's go over that story. Very interesting. Eldridge Cleaver was a Black Panther. He spent some time in prison, and he was indoctrinated in prison to the virtues of communism. And he joined the Black Panthers, and the Black Panthers, their goal was to overthrow the United States government by violent revolution and establish a black communist party apparatus to take over the government of the United States. That's what they were trying to do. Wouldn't succeed, but that was their goal. And they used violent demonstrations to do it. He wrote a book called Soul on Ice, and in it he, to just give you an idea of what he's thinking, of his thought processes, he bragged about the white women that he would rape to pay back the whitey for the oppression that they delivered upon the black people. He bragged about it. That's in his book, Soul on Ice. Anyway, he was involved in a lot of this violent revolution, and he got in a fight with a policeman, and he nearly killed a guy, but he didn't die. So he went underground, and the policemen were looking for him, and he went abroad. He went to communist nations thither and yon. First, he started out with Cuba. He went to Algeria. He went to North Vietnam. He went to China. He went to Russia. And as he went around these different places, he found out gradually that there was no racial equality in communism, in the communist world. That's what he'd been told. There is no racial inequality under communism. It does not exist. And he found that to be a bunch of bull. He found that they were just, if not more, racially biased against black people than any white American. And he gradually became to understand that communism wasn't the workers' paradise. It wasn't the great thing that it was supposed to be. And people were suffering more under communism than they ever would under capitalism. He became converted while he was abroad to the capitalistic free enterprise system and to America. And he came back voluntarily to serve his time for assault or whatever, attempted murder, whatever he had to go to undergo. Then he met a man by the name of Karl Lober. Karl Lober was a radical for the White Panthers. They were a radical group in the 60s that were trying to do the same thing as the Black Panthers, only using the white folks to do it. Karl Lober was a part of the White Panthers who became converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he baptized Eldridge Cleaver into the church. And then he became acquainted with W. Cleon Skousen, and W. Cleon ordained him an elder in the church. They went on speaking tours together. And here's a story that Eldridge Cleaver told W. Cleon, who told me. He said, while he was with the Black Panthers, he was part of their finance minister. And it was his duty to go once a month up to a bank in Canada, in Toronto, and go into this certain bank and get a check to help fund the Black Panthers next month. Now, they had contributions from other sources, but this was their main source of income. A big fat check every month. While he was there, he became introduced to the man, Carl Loeber. That's when he first met him. Carl Loeber was the finance minister for the White Panthers, and he came to the same bank to get the same check from the same people, and the people who were funding them were rich American capitalists. Eldridge Cleaver once asked him, can we use this money to help black people, like give housing for women with dependent children, or black scholarships to go to universities and better themselves? Can we use this money for clinics to give our black people better health and things like that? Can we use this money for that? And they said, absolutely not. This is only to be used for revolution, to buy guns, to make demonstrations, and to spend on your legal defense counsel if you get arrested. That's all it's to be used for, nothing else. Same thing they said to Carl Loeber. So this white guy and this black guy were funded by the same people. He became disenfranchised with the church later because his wife was cheating on him. And it destroyed him so much he could never function again. He went back to taking drugs, and he eventually died from a drug overdose. And it's such a sad end to a person who tried to find the truth. But that's the story of Eldridge Cleaver. Here's another quote from a man by the name of John Hyland, who was the mayor of New York City in 1922. He said, "The real menace of our republic is this invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. Like the octopus of real life, it operates under cover of a self-created screen. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive officers, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. It squirms in the jaws of darkness, and thus is better able to clutch the reins of government, secure enactment of the legislation favorable to corrupt business, violate the law of impunity, smother the press, and reach into the courts. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses, generally referred to as the international bankers." The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. And he said that in 1922. My goodness. It wasn't as powerful back then as it is today. They practically control both political parties, and don't you mistake it, they do. Right political platforms make cat's paws of party leaders, use the leading men in private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nominations for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of newspapers and magazines in the country. He said that in 1922. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose this invisible government. Boy, don't that make you feel warm and fuzzy inside. Now, Michael Merritt told me a lot of things when I was associated with him. He told me about the ultimate hierarchy of this great conspiracy. Here's what he says. This conspiracy is ruled at the top by seven families. The Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are the two most powerful families in that group. They often fight because Satan is the author of contention. The other five families act as a buffer between the two families. For instance, if the Rothschilds want to do something extreme, the five families will side with the Rockefellers to negate the desires of the Rothschilds, and vice versa. The five are the peacekeepers and represent the balance of power between the two families. And for the last 100 years or so, they've been able to do that. So they've had relative stability. They aren't destroying each other. It's a fairly stable system. That's at the very top, right under them. Beneath the seven families, there is a council of 13. Now, I have investigated for many years, and I have found through separate investigation, that's true. There's a council of 13 that is presided over by a council of three. Under them is the council of 33. That council of 33 consists of the 33 highest Freemasons in the world. Freemasonry is very much involved in this conspiracy. And under them is the Committee of 300. The Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the other groups, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, they're down, they're way down. The Round Table, they're down there, below this. They're in the quotations here. Mm-hmm. In their handout. Yeah, they're in the handout, but they're not in the book. I asked him point blank that very question, and he says, I won't tell you. And I don't know why he won't tell me, but he won't. This gentleman asked the question, what are the names of the five families? I can only guess, and I believe them to be the Warburgs, the Lazards, the Kuhnlobes, Israel Moses, Moses Israelson, and maybe the Morgans, but I don't know. This is the organization. You want to know where the very top is? This is what it is. The founding, many founding fathers were Masons, and there were the first five presidents of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were Masons. And many of the other founders and many of the founders of the Mormon religion, they were all Masons. You got to learn. It took me a while to understand what's going on. You know, this is one of the pieces of the puzzle that eluded me the longest. Let me explain it to you. Freemasonry was the first established in 1717 in London, England. The first Masonic lodge opened. And it was established as a fraternal organization dedicated to the upbuilding of human morality and the search of truth and all the good stuff. And originally, that was true. That's what it was started out as. But it started out as a secret organization. And when you play in the devil's backyard and you start a secret organization for the intent of doing good, pretty soon you'll find out that he will take it over and use it for his purposes. Secrecy is part of one of the strongest points that the devil can use. It gives him power. Secrecy. So it was taken over in 1782 by the Illuminati, which we have already discussed. The Illuminati worship Lucifer in 1782. But that was in Europe. Now, you got to understand something. Freemasonry at that time was under two distinct heads. There was American Freemasonry and there was Continental or European Freemasonry. European Freemasonry was taken over in 1782. But American Freemasonry had their own directors, had their own stuff. They were not taken over at that time. So George Washington joined the Freemasons because they were a good, fraternal, beneficial organization. Joseph Smith and many of the founders of the Mormon Church, they joined the Freemasons because it was a beneficial and it was a good organization. In 1870, the American head of American Freemasonry was Albert Pike. And he was approached by Giuseppe Mazzini, who was the head of European Freemasonry. And they decided to go into cahoots, and they drafted a constitution merging European Freemasonry and American Freemasonry in 1870. And in 1870, European Freemasonry introduced into American Freemasonry a certain rite which was not known until that time, and it was called the Palladian Rite. And in that rite, they preached a Gnostic doctrine which said that there are two gods in this universe. One's a good god, and one's a bad god. The good god is called Lucifer, and the bad god is called Adonai. And Adonai is the old Hebrew word for the god we worship. And when you took the Palladian rite, you swore allegiance to your good God. And from 1870, the worship of Lucifer was introduced into American Freemasonry. Before that, it was not known. There are only three places in the world where they actually perform the Palladian rite. One is in the Grand Mason Lodge of Berlin, another one in the Grand Masonry Lodge of Rome, and the third is in Washington, D.C. And they're the only places where they perform this Palladian rite. And so you can go down to the Salt Lake Masonry Temple here and ask them if they worship the devil there, and of course they'll tell you no, because they don't. Only certain high-degree Freemasons are introduced to this rite, and they have to do it in Washington, D.C., Rome, or Berlin, and that's nowhere else done. And those who do perform this rite and undergo the worship of Lucifer do not tell anyone else. So anybody from the 32nd degree on down and most of the 33rd degree have no knowledge of it. They haven't got a clue. And that's why the Founding Fathers were Freemasons and Joseph Smith was a Freemason. But I would advise anyone else to stay out of it. There are some good, well-intentioned LDS who are Freemasons because they believe in the story, the line they're told, that Freemasonry is just a fraternal organization dedicated to the pursuit of truth and the uplifting of mankind through good works and charity. They believe that. And it is true. It is partially true. I mean, they have the Shriners Hospital, which is under the direction of the Freemasons. They do a lot of good work. I'm not trying to say they don't, because they do. But that the good works they do stand out like a shield, behind which they can hide their actual conspiracy and worship of the devil. They stand before the world and say, hey, see, all these good things we do, and they do good things. The rank and file are just as good and honest as can be, but they are deceived. Well, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Now, we're coming to the end, and I want to tell you about the next lecture I have. And in that lecture, I'm going to tell you what's right with America. I'm going to tell you the stories that have been taken out of our textbooks. The stories of how God has preserved this union, how he has started it with miracle after miracle after miracle. How good and righteous men founded this nation and established the Constitution. And how the only reason that America exists today is because of the goodness and the miracles of God. And I'll give you one right here. This is to give you a prelude for the dozens of stories I'm going to tell you next time. George Washington and the Indian. He was about 22 at that time. And he was officer of the Virginia militia. And he was told by the British, who were allies with the Americans at the time, to go and survey the Ohio Valley to see where a good place, a central place, could be established for a British fort. and to see also, do a survey of what's going on there and find out what the designs of the French are. Because this is just before the French and Indian War started in 1755. So in 1753, he went to make this survey and to find a good place for a fort. He came to the forks of the Monongahela and the Allegheny River, where they joined together to make the Ohio River, and he said, this would be a good place for a fort. Eventually, they established a fort there called Fort Pitt, after William Pitt, great British statesman, and it became known as Pittsburgh. Now, during this time, though, I mean, before that happened, the French established a fort there first and called it Fort Duchesne. Anyway, he was down there surveying the land. He found out the French were going to come, and they were already shipping men and supplies to build a fort right there at the same spot, because they determined that would be a good place for a fort. And so he had to hurry back to tell his commander, his British commander, the French are coming in and they're going to start building in the Ohio Valley. And the British claimed it and the French claimed it. And they're going to go to battle over it. On the way back, he was with a man by the name of Christopher Gist, G-I-S-T. And they were traveling together. And George Washington didn't know the area, and neither did this guy, so they decided to get an Indian guide to lead them. And this was in the wintertime. So they got this Indian guide, and Christopher just says, I don't think that's a good idea. I think the Indians are allied with the French, so I don't think he's probably a French agent. Don't hire him. But George Washington hired him anyway. And he was leading him through the forest back to Governor Dinwiddie of Virginia. And all of a sudden, he came to a clearing in the forest. And the Indian all of a sudden ran straight ahead of these two men. He took out his rifle, his flintlock. And he turned around and aimed at 15 paces at George Washington and shot him. George Washington looked at his coat. There was nothing. There was no hole. There was nothing. It was like the guy had shot a blank. The Indian looked at his rifle. He couldn't believe it. Then George Washington and Christopher Gist ganged up on this Indian, bound him and gagged him, and took away his rifle and his tomahawk and everything, and Gist wanted to kill him. He wanted to kill this guy. But George Washington couldn't do it. So they let the Indian go one direction and they went the other. This is what I call an example of the bulletproof George Washington. There are three instances that I know of in American history where George Washington was subjected to direct gunfire. This is one of them. There are two other instances. And they're even worse than this. I mean, they were even more unbelievable than this. Three instances where he is subject to direct gunfire and he didn't get a wound. I'll tell you the other two instances next month. That's the hook. There are many examples of this in American history where God has prevailed upon mankind to do his will. People have responded, and he has protected them with divine providence. You come and learn the true history of America, not the pablum that they serve you, the brainwashing that they serve you in the public schools. The true history. God had an overwhelming influence. You just don't know about it. It just is not taught anymore. But you will learn. Thank you very much for attending here. Thank you.